On the evening of April 3, 2025, the country bookshelf was filled with over 100 people who had come to hear Amy Gamerman, author of The Crazies, in conversation with Bozeman environmental journalist Amanda Eggert. The Crazies tells the story of the 21st century range war between fifth-generation rancher Rick Jarrett, who believed in his right to make a living off his land, as had his ancestors, as well as address the urgent need for renewable energy by planting windmills on his property. The problem was, his new neighbors, who were some of the wealthiest and most powerful families on the planet, recent trophy ranchers, did not want their magnificent mountain views to include those proposed 500-foot wind turbines. Amy Gamerman's The Crazies is a Western for a warming planet, full of cowboys and billionaires and billionaire cowboys, but it's also so much more. It's an exquisitely reported, ruggedly beautiful elegy for a vanishing way of life and a big-hearted inquiry into how you can love a place so much you risk destroying it. The audience was riveted by this conversation. At times, the silence in the room, but for the speaker, was audible. KGVM was there to record this community event, which was introduced by the Country Bookshelf's Nell Gerke.
My name is Nell. I'm the events and marketing manager here at Country Bookshelf. I've been in this role since 2022, and this is the largest event that I've ever hosted. So thank you all so much for being here. Amanda Eggert is an environmental journalist based here in Bozeman. In January 2021, she joined the staff for the Montana Free Press. Her stories about Montanans' housing affordability challenges, land use issues in central Montana's Crazy Mountains, and the intersection of drought and Montana's treasured cold water fisheries have won awards. When not working, she can be found exploring Montana's mountains and rivers with her two young sons and collie mix. We also have Amy Gamerman, has written about real estate and culture for the Wall Street Journal for more than two decades. The Crazies is her first book.
Thank you all so much for being here. It is an honor for me to come here with my first book about Montana and meet people who are actually from Montana and care deeply about the issues that I wrote about and encountered really as an outsider. I'm very grateful. I thought that I would begin, before Amanda and I do our thing, just reading a very brief passage from the book. And this is really about a fight between neighbors at its core. But the person at the heart of this book is a fifth-generation cattle rancher named Rick Jarrett. And Rick and his determination to ensure the future of his ranch drives the action of a very dramatic story. So I would just like to give you a brief introduction to Rick. Rick was a rancher. He never had the imagination to be anything else, he said. His people had ranched in Big Timber since 1882. Cattle first, then sheep, then cattle and some sheep. Any Montanan who makes his living off livestock will tell you that what he really does is raise grass. Rick raised fields of alfalfa and orchard grass and timothy hay and forage winter wheat to be cut and baled for the long winters. When spring came in April or May, he'd turn the calves and the mother cows out on fresh green grass. Everything came in cycles on a ranch, just as it had for Rick's grandparents and his great-grandparents. Being a rancher meant knowing how to do things, how to brand a calf, dock a lamb, break a colt, mending a barbed wire fence, cleaning out a clogged irrigation ditch so the water could flow clear and cold to your hay fields, knowing when to cut the hay and how many days to let it cure in the sun before you baled it. Those were essential skills, along with a basic grasp of cattle futures, soil science, and veterinary medicine. You preg-checked your cows by sticking your arm up the rectum and giving a squeeze. If a calf got stuck in a heifer's birth canal, you'd loop a chain over its fetlock and slowly tug it free. Then you'd get some suture thread from the floor of your truck and stitch up the torn mother cow. Not every calf lived. Not every heifer survived. You saw a lot of death on the ranch, so you adapted. You'd skin the dead calf, then tie its pelt to the orphan, fooling the bereaved bovine into suckling it like it was her own. It took a lifetime to acquire such knowledge. Rick could kill a rattlesnake with a rock or a rein, drive a fence post, cook beef goulash. If it busted, he fixed it. Rick always had a bit of wire or baling twine on hand if a gate didn't hook right or his suspenders snapped under the strain. When his tractor sputtered or the muffler fell off his 1987 Cadillac Brougham, he'd scavenge a spare part from one of the many junked vehicles that dotted his land. To be a rancher was to be a master of the workaround, to make do with what you had and get on with it. This was called ranching it. The corollary to ranching it was that your ranch looked like shit because you never threw anything away. Rick's ranch was an open-air museum of historic farm machinery in various stages of decay, with the serrated white and blue peaks of the Crazy Mountains for a backdrop. He called it the Crazy Mountain Cattle Company. And that is just a very quick introduction to Rick.
All right. Good evening. I'd like to start by talking about how you got to know the individuals in this book so well. It's such an intimate portrayal of so many really fascinating people with such different stories. And I'd really like to learn a little bit more about how you came to get to know them so well to write about them with such detail and color and liveliness.
There are an extraordinary group of people who all happen to have been drawn to this beautiful part of Montana in the shadow of the Crazy Mountains, in the South Crazies. And my very first introduction to these people was when I was reporting a story for the Wall Street Journal in 2017. I write for a section of the Wall Street Journal called Mansion. The name is only partly tongue-in-cheek. It's devoted to the housing aspirations, the second home, the third home, the ski home, the beach house, the island of the 0.0001%. And in 2017, I was writing a profile of a Texas oil and gas billionaire named Russell Gordy, who collects ranches. He had a $96 million collection of ranches spread across the West. Beautiful ranches. And we were going to do a limited tour of some of his favorites. And the Montana Ranch in the Crazies was the absolute crown jewel of his collection. It was his favorite ranch. So while we were walking around, looking at the ruins of the old Hot Springs Resort that he bought along with the rest of his acres, acres and acres, the ranch extends from the Yellowstone River up into the Crazies. He mentioned that the rancher just over his border to the south wanted to lease his land for a wind farm. And his face darkened, just like clouded over, as he described how this was going to ruin his views and kill all the birds he loved to hunt and wreck his property values. And kind of joking, but really not, I said, well, why don't you buy him out? And he said, I have. I've tried. And the man's not interested. He set on doing that wind farm. And even though this had absolutely nothing to do with the story that I was there to report, I would find myself thinking about this exchange months later. Who is this rancher who said no to this very imposing billionaire? And what is it like to say no to someone with so much money? And whatever happened with his wind farm? And in 2019, kind of doing a random internet search, I stumbled across a little news item about a lawsuit that was unfolding in the Crazies. And there were a couple of old ranchers whose families had been in Montana for a long time, and a wind energy company from San Francisco, and then a bunch of LLCs, very generic sounding. Wild Eagle, Rock Creek. One was called Diana's Great Idea. So I'm like, who are these? And you know, you do a little bit of digging and, well, behind those LLCs were some of the wealthiest and most powerful people in America. And they had joined forces to stop this very small wind development project. It was only months later that I found out that my profile of the Texan was Exhibit 9 in one of the legal filings filed by the ranchers. So that was my first introduction to these folks. And the process of really getting to know them, I knew was going to be, that was a non-negotiable. It was essential because it was clear that this was a remarkable part of the world and that the people who were engaged in this conflict all felt very strongly about it. And in order to understand what was driving them, I really had to learn how to see what it was they were seeing when they looked at those mountains, and that this was really going to involve spending time and listening and getting to know them. So the book took a good 5 years of reporting and writing to do, and it was a process. And I will say that very early on, Rick's daughter, Jamie, made a decision to speak to me and to decide that she was going to trust me enough to introduce me to her dad, Rick. And I do believe that that was a pivotal moment, and that had that initial decision to trust and to extend herself that way not been made, perhaps this book might not have been written.
One of the other things that I really love about the book is that I learned so much about things that are actually really technical and pretty complicated, including how public utility commissions work and how energy law unfolds over multiple years, and even about ranching and land management. And I'm curious if there's an aspect of research you did for the book that you're particularly proud of.
Okay. I am so proud of my PSC chapter. The Public Service Commission is the most obscure and perhaps most boring of all government agencies. It is a handful of men in a room making decisions about how you and your children are going to be getting your power for the next 25 years. And it is cloaked in obscure acronyms and language and arm wavers and LEOs. And it's almost like listening to a language you don't speak. And what I found was that, in fact, what these five men were doing when they sat down and made decisions about, say, granting a power purchase agreement to a small wind project, was that they were not just following the laws that were on the books. And it actually took, you know, weeks of listening to commission hearings. They're all recorded on the PSC website, to begin to even understand that, oh, wait a minute, they just said, yeah, we know that's the law, but maybe it won't be the law next year. So having to really dig into that world, I just decided I'm going to lean into the boring, because I've really got to understand this, because what these folks are doing in Helena have profound implications for everybody in the state. And it's not just about this colorful battle, this range war between billionaires and cowboys. This is also unfolding on a government level. And what exactly is going on there? So I am proud of that. Yes.
Last year, I got a chance to meet Bill McKibben, a climate scientist for a long time. And he described public utility commissions as being protected by a force field of boringness. And I think you really penetrated that force field in this book. And I think we're all probably better off for knowing a little bit more about how it works. So
thank you.
Something else I'm curious about is, so you finished the book last summer. Your final revisions were into your editor last summer, and a lot has changed both locally here in southern Montana, nationally. And I'm just curious how the book might resonate differently now than it did when you finished it.
Do you mean for me or for the person who's reading it?
Both. Yeah. We'll go with you first.
Yeah. I've spent decades working as a journalist, and when you are writing a piece for the newspaper, like, you are updating that thing until the minute they pull it out of your hands, you know. The goal is always to be as current as you can. And with a book, it's simply not possible because the lead time is so long. And there were specific things that were going on, say, with the land exchange plan, with the Forest Service plan and the Eastern Crazies, with the climate lawsuit that the young people had filed against the state. There were things that were still evolving, and that it was clear my book was far from the last word on any of this. And for that matter, the ranchers themselves are all real people, and their lives continue beyond the endpoint, the very arbitrary endpoint that I impose on the story. And I think what I had to come to terms with was that it was my job not to anticipate the future, but to bring every skill that I have to communicating a story of what had happened to get us here to the moment that we were at, to tell the story of what had happened to these people and to their families, because this story had not been told. And I felt that this story spoke to maybe some larger themes that are unfolding in Montana that maybe will have relevance beyond next week or next month or next year. And that is the struggle of ranching families to continue a way of life that perhaps worked for their grandparents or their great-grandparents, but that has become increasingly difficult to sustain. And that, I believe, has really profound implications for everyone, not just Montanans, for Americans. If the cowboys all go away, the idea of America, the idea America has of itself, well, the West is absolutely central to that. Even for people who have never been West, Montana represents something. It represents wilderness. It represents freedom. It represents a person pitting themselves against the elements in a very direct way. And when the people who are doing all of that, struggling to raise cattle and continue a ranching lifestyle, are no longer able to do that, and they have to go away, and their ranch has to turn into a ranchette for some wealthy out-of-towner. Well, who are we as a nation if we don't have that anymore? The cowboy and the cowboy myth, they may be very romanticized, but there's something, there are real people here who are struggling to maintain the very best of what that represents. And so I felt that there was really a kind of urgency to communicating that. And that's what I'm trying to do anyway.
Earlier tonight, we were talking about how this story can read a little bit differently for people for whom the West is kind of more of an idea, and people who live here and are kind of familiar with these battles outside of the abstract, and they really understand the stakes in a more personal way. And I'd love if you could speak to that a little bit about some of those differences that you've noticed as you've done your book tour and thought about these things.
Everyone is going to read the book a different way. I mean, there are many stories that are told in it. There are a lot of overlapping dramas. Like, on one level, this is a courtroom drama. There is a legal battle that lasts well over a decade that is kind of underpinning a lot of the action. On another, it's like a clash between really colorful personalities and really extraordinary people who had to do extraordinary things in their lives to get to be in the crazies, in the case of some of these extremely wealthy newcomers. You know, what it was that brought each one of them there. Each one of these people, in a way, could be their own book. They're all fascinating. Oh, and then there's another very important piece to this, which is the Crazy Mountains. They are special, right? There is a magnetism to this landscape. And these mountains have been drawing people to them for not just the last decades, not just trophy ranchers, not just homesteaders. They've been drawing people to them for thousands of years. And so there was a level on which it was really important to me to get at what that charisma was of this place. Because honestly, if a mountain range could have sex appeal, the crazies have got it in spades. And so there was another level in which I was looking at the pull of deep time and how these mountains had meant something to people for so many years. I mean, for millennia. So every person who reads the book, depending on where they are in their journey, is going to pick up maybe on a different thing. I am not a young woman. I'm in my very early 60s. And for a lot of my friends, they're absolutely fascinated with the story of Monica Trunnell, a woman who has had tremendous success, but also tremendous setbacks and failures, let's be honest, has experienced a life-defining failure. She's an Olympic athlete who is favored to win gold as a rower and comes in fourth, which for most of us would seem great, but not for her. She finds a new calling. She is now in her new life as an attorney. She finds a tremendous new purpose in the cause of these ranchers and fighting for their right to control what they do on their land. And so for a lot of the women that I know, it was kind of like, well, tell me more about Monica, you know? Because if you've lived a bit, you come to have a lot of sympathy for the idea of how failure can be as important a definition, a defining experience as your successes have been.
Speaking of women doing very difficult things, you are a mother of four. And as a mother of two, I am so inspired by you taking on a book.
Thank you.
And especially a project of 5 years that required so much research. And for all of the other parents out there, I'd love it if you could talk a little bit about how you managed to swing that.
Four children and first book is at this age. So, I mean, talk about a late bloomer. It's funny, just as I was saying about how a failure can give you something, having to care for children can also teach you a lot over the years. You can learn a lot from your kids. My kids were all older when I started working on this book. I can't say enough about the virtues of noise-canceling headphones. Let's put it that way. My office is a little room right off my kitchen. Those of you with children will know that kitchen cabinets get opened and closed a lot. Like the snack thing is on constant. So those headphones saved my life.
I think this is the time we're going to open it up to audience questions.
The question was, how did you actually get to know the billionaires and millionaires? It's a mix. Like, we got some billionaires and then just some mere millionaires mixed in. I had gotten to know Russell Gordy in the course of writing this profile, and we'd spent a lot of time together. And so he had my number, I had his number. And Russell Gordy and I shared an experience together. Russell flies his own helicopters. His wife, Glenda, gave him a helicopter for a birthday present. And then when he didn't have time to take the lessons, she bought him the helicopter company so that they could work around his schedule. So he had his helicopter pilot license, and he loved to fly. And part of our tour was that he was going to take me up in his helicopter, and we were going to fly from his Montana ranch to his Wyoming ranch, because that would be so fun. Well, as soon as we got up in the air, we ran into very bad weather. As you all know, in the Rockies, the weather can just change in an instant. And we were suddenly flying into a cloud bank that just wasn't letting up. It was like flying inside a cotton ball. And he started to get very nervous. He started saying, "This isn't good, Amy. This isn't good. This is not good." He's a big practical joker. He just wants to make me scared. No, it was really bad. So anyway, long story short, we landed safely. The clouds cleared up. We all lived. But, you know, after you go through an experience like that with someone, they do tend to answer your phone calls. As for the others, it's interesting how different each one of these people is. I mean, we're all different people. Billionaires are not a monolith. They're people too. So there was a different method was required for each particular person. The McMillan family, they are very, very private. I would say private to the point of secretive family. They're one of the wealthiest families on the planet. They are the heirs to the Cargill agribusiness empire. They have a ranch high up in the crazies and would spend maybe a few weeks of the year there. Whitney McMillan loved fishing, and he'd go fly fishing and lived a very humble lifestyle when he was there. So the question of how do I get to Whitney McMillan? Well, there was a wildlife biologist that we both knew. So it was a question of talking to this wildlife biologist. And alas, just as we were getting closer, Whitney died before we could speak. And then I will tell a funny story about one of the mere millionaires. One of the neighbors who joins in this effort is a Las Vegas attorney, is a celebrity attorney named David Chesnoff. He's like Sin City's top litigator. If you are Britney Spears and you got married on a whim to your high school boyfriend, like, he gets it annulled inside of 24 hours. If you get busted with some cocaine in your purse on a traffic stop, he's the guy you call. So this guy is there too, and he is the most connected man in Las Vegas. The mayor of Las Vegas throws his birthday party. So I had been in touch with him, and after a few initial encouraging conversations, suddenly everything, the radio silence, it went dead. He wasn't answering my calls or my texts or my letters or my Christmas cards. So then I thought, well, this guy, he's all about his connections. He's all about these powerful friends he's made. So I started calling his friends. and just saying, I'm writing this story about the crazies and this beautiful mountain area where your friend David has his ranch, and he sounds so interesting. Anything you can tell me about him, I'd love to hear it. And after about 10 days of this, my phone rang on a Saturday. It's David Chesnoff. I hear you've been talking to my friends. And I said, yes, well, I'm so glad to talk to you. I just wanted to ask, what do you want to know? And I said, okay, how does a nice Jewish boy from Long Island end up being Las Vegas's top criminal defense attorney? And there's a silence, a long silence. Who says I'm nice? But it was the start of a great relationship. We broke the ice, so it took a different tack. And again, this is over a long period of time, right? So there's a conversation, then there's maybe another conversation, then there's a, oh, I'm going to be in Montana when you're in Montana. Could I come by? It took a while. The question was, with the wealthy newcomers, the trophy ranchers, whether they had a sense of empathy for their neighbors who are just working blokes, or they're working ranchers. They've had a ranch that's been in their family, and they've got to do what they have to do to hang on to that land. And is there sympathy for that? Is there understanding of that? So I think what was really important to me in understanding this book, or in telling it the way that I thought but the story had to be told, was that there were no good guys. There were no bad guys. The rich people were not bad guys. And in fact, they thought that what they wanted was in the best interests of this place that they loved. And not just in their best interest, but in the best interests of everyone who lived there, because they were going to preserve it. And in fact, everyone in this conflict, as heated as it becomes and as ugly as the behavior becomes, they're basically operating from, let's say, a good place, because they really care about this land. It's just what they see when they look at it is so different. So they're not looking at Rick Jarrett and saying, look at this guy. He wants to harness the wind as a crop. He wants to harvest this new resource on his land so he can keep this ranch and his family. What they're seeing is, I need to save this landscape from windmills. You know, it's okay to have cows on this land. He can keep running his cows, but windmills are going to ruin it for everyone. There's a lack of, I guess, not just, I don't even want to say it's not empathetic, but it's just the perspective is completely different. And a word that would come up over and over again when I did spend time with these more wealthy folks was legacy. They all talked about legacy. This ranch is my legacy. This beautiful landscape, these mountains, they're my legacy to my children. They're my legacy in a greater sense, because look at this landscape that I have essentially preserved. It's almost like a beautiful multi-thousand acre artwork, and I'm going to keep it behind glass because that's what the West should be. And if that's the perspective they're operating from, then they're not even clued into their lack of empathy, if that makes sense. And what I began to think about quite a bit was that there's perhaps nothing more uniquely American or more dangerous than the self-made man, because you start with something so admirable, a person who's resourceful and hardworking and determined and ready to push through any obstacle. There's just so much good there, right? That's kind of like the American spirit. But what happens after you've got your first billion? And that behavior just continues unabated. And in fact, the more money that you get and the more power that you accrue, the more unbridled you become. And you don't even realize that you're not punching through obstacles, you're punching down. And just on that note, what I also came to understand, and talking about legacy and stuff, is that what being a billionaire is about, and by the way, if you've been considering it, I recommend it highly, is that being a billionaire, it's not about buying things. It's not about the pretty stuff. It's not about the private island. It's not about the racehorses. It's not about the mountain you ski down. No, it's not that. It's about having the power to condition your own reality so that you never see anything ugly you never deal with anything unpleasant like your neighbor's windmills. And increasingly, in a place like the Crazies, like Big Timber, where you have so much wealth flowing into the area, what that means is they are able to condition the reality of their neighbors as well. Thank you for that question. The question is about the story of the indigenous people in the Crazies. And did I learn something new about it? And basically, I learned everything about it because I knew nothing about it. On one level, the story of the Crazies, it's a ghost story. It's a haunted landscape. It's haunted by the generations of people who are dispossessed. This was all Crow country once, and the Crow people were ejected from the Crazies, which was a sacred landscape to them, and pushed onto a reservation well over 100 miles to the east. And I realized that what's missing from the landscape, the people who aren't there, become as much of a kind of spectral presence, an important presence, as the people who are there, because the Crazies are still absolutely essential to them, to their sense of culture and their connection and spirituality. And it goes even beyond that. I think for me, the most profoundly, like the truly, like the most eye-opening discovery for me was learning the story of the Clovis child, who is also sometimes referred to as the Anzac child. The Clovis child lived and died 13,000 years ago. He was between the ages of 1 and 2, and his burial site was discovered in the 60s. He was buried in the side of a cliff directly facing the Crazy Mountains. It's a spot in Wilsall. And he was buried with an extraordinary trove of objects, stone tools, hundreds, well over 100 stone spear points and axes and scrapers that had all been created to be buried with him. An extraordinary trove of objects. This child was very important to his people. And they were a nomadic people. 13,000 years ago, this part of Montana has just emerged from the ice sheets, right? And why, of all the places that was in the known world to these folks, like of all the places these people who traveled over Beringia to get to Montana, why this place did they put this extraordinary child and this extraordinary collection of objects that contained the most important elements of their culture? Like, why did they put it here? Why in the Crazies? And then this layer of astonishment was then like doubled and then tripled when I learned that a paleogeneticist had sequenced the DNA, was able to extract a bit of ancient DNA from the child's bones, and after years of working to sequence this DNA, discovered that this child, who lived 13,000 years ago, was related to 80% of all indigenous Americans in North America and South America. What an extraordinary evolutionary success story. And when I spoke to the scientist, he said, you know, I'm a scientist, but if you are ever going to use a word like atom in a scientific context, then this child is atom. And then a shiver went down my spine because I thought, if this child is atom, then this place where his people chose to put him, well, it must be Eden. So the question was, from somebody who knows the Crazies very well and has hiked in the Crazies for years and years and has encountered this, I think, relatively new phenomenon of the no trespassing sign. I don't need to tell this group of people that the Crazies are a very problematic landscape because they are, for the most part, privately owned. And the public land in the mountains is often locked behind square mile sections of private land. And these private landowners do not look kindly on public access through their private land to get to that public land. And this is an ongoing struggle. So they would say things like, oh, we had trouble with people harassing the wildlife. Or, oh, I'm thinking about safety, like because if something happened. You know, there's always a reason, but I will tell you like a very tiny anecdote about this. So there's this whole thing about talking about conservation. One of the delicious ironies of this story for me was that a Texas oil tycoon who made his fortune drilling and fracking and leasing land for longwall coal mining and proposing to blow up a Wisconsin mountain range to get the taconite out of it when iron ore prices were high, he drapes himself in the mantle of environmental stewardship. In the name of saving the crazies, he wants to defeat this wind farm because he is a conservationist. But what I really came to think was, yes, it's true. They do care about conserving the landscape. But is it conservation or is it like curating? Because it's like, this is my beautiful land. Please don't mess it up. They have assembled something of tremendous value, of aesthetic value, of extreme financial value. And honestly, you wouldn't want somebody just walking into your room and looking at your Picasso either, would you? So I think there is that element to it, that this is mine and I need to protect it. And part of protecting it includes keeping you off of it. And that may be ungenerous. I mean, please feel free if somebody wants to push back against that. The question is about legacy from someone who actually is a tenant of Russell and Glenda Gordy and lives on Rock Creek Ranch. And the Gordys are really nice people. I mean, I hope when you read this book, I tell the stories of each of these people. And it's my hope that when you are reading about them, that you will find yourself rooting for them, that you are kind of seduced by them because they are amazing people. And I was seduced by them in a way. I was rooting for each one of them in turn. But I do think there was something very telling in the way that Russell framed his answer to you. He said, as long as this land belongs to my family, it will be preserved. Okay, that's not the same thing as saying, I am going to turn this land over to the public as a national park. And there is also a kind of finite nature to that, as long as my family owns it. Well, what happens when your family doesn't own it anymore? And I just want to say a word about conservation easements. I'll answer your question about David Lucien, and I think that will do it. David Lucien is a private equity billionaire. He assumes an extraordinary role in this story. He is like the king of the crazies. His ranch is the loftiest. His peaks are the highest. He literally sits above this landscape, this magnificent mountain ranch. And it turns out that his private equity fund owns the wind development company that is proposing to put the wind farm on the Jarrett's land. And as he himself tells me at one point, it's like I'm on all sides of this thing because Russell's my neighbor and Whitney's my neighbor. If they're against this, I'm not going to tell them it's a good thing, but I sit on the board of this wind company. So he's like, it's like the Wizard of Oz. He's up there in this, sitting in the clouds on Crazy Peak, which is his peak. And he described his vision of this legacy to me this way. I'm going to try to paraphrase what he said. He said, it's a constant battle. I have 35,000 acres here, and they're pretty much all in conservation easements, which means they will never be developed in any way. You will never see anything ugly on it. You'll never see a trailer park. You'll never see a junkyard. But then the guy just outside of my property line builds an ugly little ranch house. Now, what did I do? I gave that guy his national park. Does he thank me for it? No. So it's a constant struggle. So this notion of legacy, I think, has an element of narcissism in it, if we're being unkind, that it's seeing yourself reflected in this magnificent landscape. And I think it also needs to be pointed out that conservation easements bring tremendous tax benefits to the landowners who enter into them. So they are essentially getting their cake and eating it. They have their beautiful ranch, which they weren't going to put a junkyard or a subdivision on to begin with, and they're getting a tax write-off on it too. It's a very complicated question, but none of which is to say that Russell and Glenda's intentions aren't good. It's just a little more complicated than that, I think. And it would be awesome if they decide to turn it into a national park, the way the Rockefellers did. And
on the note of public access and differing notions about whether or not a landscape should be shared and how how it should be shared? If so, I think some of y'all might be aware that there was a decision on corner crossing in the Ninth Circuit arising out of a Wyoming hunting lawsuit that was decided, appealed, and decided again in favor of these hunters that crossed corners of checkerboard land to go hunting. And I was speaking with someone from Wyoming who is familiar with the appellate decision in that case. He's in Wyoming now, but he grew up in Montana, and he kind of likened it to Montana's stream access law in saying that there's a period of adjustment. Landowners might not be very happy with it for a while, but eventually they'll come around to understanding the kind of new lay of the land when it comes to public access. But Montana is really unique in the United States for how we think about access, particularly when it comes to water, but for other issues too. And I think it's fascinating to take some of those regional differences in account as you're thinking about how land is used, who uses it, how they use it, what kind of permission is allowed, how wildlife is managed. There are just so many issues implicated here.
Amanda, what do you make of that whole I'm conserving it thing then? And the conservation, and I've got it all in conservation easements.
Speaking as Amanda Agert, private citizen, not Amanda Agert, journalist, I love open landscapes. And I think conservation easements have done a lot for open landscapes. I think we also need to acknowledge that sometimes you just get a look at them. Other times you have access to them for certain times of the year. If you hunt, maybe you go to block management to hunt elk or something. And I think open lands are so widely treasured in Montana. I think that's near universal, I would say. But conservation easements also have some very vocal detractors. There are efforts to change how they can be used. There are efforts to remove the perpetuity thing. It's a live debate, I would say.
The question is about the legal battle that culminates in a three-day injunction hearing where the wealthy neighbors have taken the wind energy company and the ranchers themselves to court. They're suing them to block, really to seek an injunction to stop all work on the wind farm. If you're parsing it, it's not about killing it, although the effect will be to kill it. Because if you know, not to get too deep into the boring again or into the weeds of energy regulatory policy, but the way that power purchase agreements with Northwestern Energy are created, they are finite. There are conditions. The wind energy needs to be delivered by a certain date, or your agreement with them is null and void, and Northwestern Energy is no fan of wind. So there's that pressure. So what the defendants understood was that if their wealthy neighbors won and they were able to get this injunction to delay work on the wind farm, that the project would essentially be dead. So they knew that. The question is about the judge and why he ruled the way he did. And I don't want to give away too much because we do have books to sell. But I do not think the judge is an ideologue. And I also think that hindsight is 20/20. I spent years piecing apart this case and looking at the various aspects of it. And when you do that, when you Sunday quarterback a game, you know, it's so obvious he should have just caught the ball. It's very hard, and I'm not a lawyer, to go into it and say how they should have done it. I will say that I think when you go up against so much money that it's going to be very hard the way our legal system is structured, because there's always another appeal. There's always another level you can take it to. You can sue the county. You can sue the wind energy company over what it's doing to your road. You can find something else. And as somebody in the wind energy company says to me at one point, if they want to, they could litigate this to the end of time. And so I wouldn't run to any conclusions about it. I think what is so interesting about this case is that in Montana, this is a place where there's a legacy of independence, self-reliance, and a belief that your land should be yours to do what you want with it. I would say that's like a kind of a core belief, right? And how these ranchers who were essentially exercising that right to use their land as they saw fit, how they were able to be stymied, I think is a really serious question. So I'll leave it there because I don't want to give away more. Well, I mean, really, writing a book is a very different thing than writing an article. I wanted to keep myself out of it as much as I could. That the question is about my voice as a writer. I wanted to do whatever I could within my abilities to get the voices of the people I was writing about in there. That was my goal, was to almost get you in their head through things that they had spoken to me, things they had said to me, things they had said in court depositions, things they had said at county commission meetings. I really wanted them to get the stage. Like, these were people who hadn't gotten to tell their stories, and I wanted you to hear it from them, if that makes sense. I got this book contract in January of 2019. I made my first trip out to Montana in late February and had an extraordinary time. I met Rick Jarrett. I met Alfred Anderson, his neighbor. I met a lot of folks. I spent a lot of time in Big Timber. I came back so excited about this new life that was opening up for me in Big Timber, where I was going to be spending all my time. 10 days later, the entire world shut down and nobody was going anywhere. And that ended up being a gift, because I used that time to really learn, to learn about this place, to learn about Big Timber, to learn about the kind of unique set of life events and the history, the American history that had gone into shaping this area and that had brought each one of these people there, and that you couldn't understand why they were there or how they were so invested if you didn't know all of that. And that was just sitting and reading and researching. And fortunately, a library technician at one of the university libraries would take photographs of documents and email them to me. It was such a nice thing to do. So I was able to visit the archives that way. I was reading. I was listening to hearings. Just that puts you right back in the moment when you listen to a county commission meeting and hear people getting so exercised. And it's like you're right there. Like, my blood pressure would start going up when these people were fighting. So really, it was kind of like everything all at once. Whatever I could do, when I could do it, was what I was doing. And that is why it took as long as it did, because there was so much to do and there were so many overlapping layers and different paths to go down that at some points it was like, I'm in a free fall here. Like, there's so much to look into. There's the PSC, there's this, there's that. But what kept me grounded was just the story. When I felt like I was kind of like spinning out, I would just think, you know, tell Rick's story. Trust the story of Rick and his neighbors. Just focus on the story. Tell the story.
When I was preparing for this talk yesterday, I was looking at the footnote section of the book, and I just like to point out there's 27 pages of footnotes. So it's a huge volume of research.
Yes. I'm also proud of my endnotes. I think I've answered every question in the world. Yes. Yes.
Do you have any new projects?
So I am looking into something new, but it's a little too early to talk about, but it is not Montana. You can all heave a sigh of relief. But it's a wonderful thing to be able to immerse yourself in a book. And perhaps it has something to do with the pandemic. But there were times when I was so deep into this research that these folks and their lives and their problems felt more immediate and more real to me than my own did. And that's really a gift. And it tells something about how extraordinary the people at the heart of this book really are. They are exceptional. This is a once-in-a-lifetime story for a writer to tell. And I'm so grateful that I got to tell it. It's the gift of a lifetime, truly. And there are people in this room who helped make that possible. And I am forever grateful to them for that. So I just want to put that out there. Thank you.
You have just heard a recording of Amy Gammerman, author of The Crazies, in conversation with Bozeman environmental journalist Amanda Eggert. It took place at the Country Bookshelf on the evening of April 3rd, 2025. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LaClaire for broadcast and archiving on KGVM Bozeman and KGVM.org. Thanks to Nell Gerke and Yvonne Rudman for production assistance. Gallatin Valley Community Radio is entirely volunteer-staffed, and we depend on the financial support of you, our listeners, to bring you programs such as this of, by, and for our community. You can do your part to keep this station thriving by going to kgvm.org and click on the Gold Support KGVM button at the top of the page. We thank you for listening and for your support.